It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello, everyone. This is Randy Zarnke. I'll be your host for today's edition of Alaska Tracks. It's a real pleasure to share these oral history interviews with you. I spent many years collecting these recordings, and I want to thank KFAR and our sponsors for giving us the opportunity to share these great stories with our listeners. Today's featured guest is Ken Deerdorf, who hails from the community of McGrath. Ken is an effective and respected hunter, trapper, and fisherman. In this first segment, Ken describes how he got started in his outdoor lifestyle, how and when he came to Alaska, and a few things he learned about building cabins and mushing dogs. Let's listen to him now.
Well, I grew up in Southern California. I was born in 1944, and I had an uncle, my mother's brother, that saw to it that by the time I was 4 years old, I had a subscription to Field & Stream. I can remember every month, before I could even really read, I'd stare at the cover of the magazine and try to determine which way was north in that picture. You know, I'd look at all the shadows and look at the way the plants grew and things like that. And of course, I never had any way of knowing whether I was right or not, but it was at least fun to try. I devoured those things every month when they would arrive. And then by the time I was about seven, I read a Reader's Digest condensed book called Crusoe of Lonesome Lake. The guy was homesteading in 1900 in British Columbia. And that kind of got me really pointed north, set my sights on eventually getting to Alaska. And I moved up here and homesteaded down on the Stony River in 1974. That was the first year that I trapped. It was the fall of 1974. It wasn't a real successful year. I think I caught one ermine, one mink, and one marten, and a beaver. And I was out there every single day trying to. It was fun right from the start. And I was amazed at how difficult it could be to set that little number one. You know, a number one jump is what I was using for marten at the time. And, you know, I'd never even seen a trap growing up in California or a snare. It got kind of discouraging day after day after day, walking 7 or 8 miles, and finally caught one marten. The habitat on that river is just horrible for marten. Great fox habitat, wonderful, and some of the nicest colors and best hair I've seen on fox, but I think the best year I ever had was about 30 marten. That took a lot of work, but the best year I ever had on fox was right around 100. There's a creek to the west of where I lived at the time. It had a lot of whitefish in it, big whitefish run in the fall. And the foxes would congregate over there. I mean, it was like every fox in Western Alaska would, you know, spend the winter right there. I don't know where they were getting them, but they, you know, you would find remains of whitefish, you know, in the snow or in the ice and where the foxes had been working on them. And it was real productive as far as fox, and that was great because in those years foxes were pretty high. I was averaging about 150 on reds, and I remember actually getting 200 for a cross fox that year. I was selling to a guy in Sleep Mute at the time. So marten, where the marten were a little bit short, the fox sure made up for it. Because marten then, I think I got $10 for that small marten that year and $18 for a male the next year. Yeah, we didn't really get good marten prices until about the early 80s. Remember that, those days.
Now, you mentioned that when you first went into that country, you had homesteaded.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that process. How did you pick the country and how did you get started? Did you have the skills to really build your own cabin, or was it a little bit a learning process?
Oh, it was certainly a learning process. I had just gotten out of college in Northern California, and as I said, from the time I was seven, the idea was to get to Alaska somehow. Somebody said to me, "Why don't you homestead?" And I thought, you know, that's a good idea. Why don't I? So I looked into it and found that there was still open to entry land. I contacted BLM and saw where that open to entry land was. They were very accommodating at the Anchorage office. They had a large base map and lots of mylar overlays with, you know, vegetation and hydrology and different population distributions of both people and animals. And I could see where there was a lot of homesteading going on one particular river, and I knew I didn't want to be there, so I picked a river where there was no one. It was February. I was dropped off there. I had two 185 loads of gear with me, set up a little two-man nylon tent, made a fire. That was my biggest concern, was will I be able to make a fire at zero or whatever the temperature is? Well, of course you can. It took me about a month on snowshoes with a chainsaw to get a little 12 by 12 built. Of course, it wasn't peeled or anything like that, and it was built on the snow. I'd packed the snow down as well as I could. Very nice to get out of that little tent and get into that 12 by 12 with a little airtight stove in there and get it cherry red. And it was nice to be warm, and it was nice not to be sleeping in that tent. What a poor choice that was. If I had known at the time, I would have brought a canvas wall tent or something like that. But being right out of California, I didn't have any idea about the fact that my breath would condense and freeze into huge frost flowers on the inside of that nylon tent. And then I'd sit up in the morning and try to get dressed, and it would all be falling down my neck and in my sleeping bag and in my clothes. And it was actually a joy to get out, even if it was 20 or 30 below, get out of that tent, you know, because at least I could make a fire again and get some coffee going and then get to work and get warmed up. My wife finally showed up there the 1st of April. We started right in building a larger cabin and had that finished by the following December. Lots of hard work, horrible mosquitoes, you know, worse than my imaginings. I had never heard of PIC because growing up in California, the age of DDT back then, you know, and there just weren't any. Somebody from Lyme Village said, "Don't you have any PIC?" I didn't. Didn't even know what it was. So then I was shown how to get the punks off the side of birch trees and burn those. And that certainly helped. You know, it'd make you kind of dizzy at the same time. And, oh, yeah, my first introduction to PIC that summer. What a godsend that was. Just to be able to eat without swatting mosquitoes. I finally got title to that land in 88 or 89. I originally staked 80, and I filed my final proof on 49.9 acres of that. About 10 years after I filed the final proof, I got the title.
And now, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's not your home base for your trapping operation.
That's correct, it is not. But it was for a long time the eastern end of the line. I would run from there to the cabin in the center, and then to a couple of tent camps on the far west and south end, and then work my way back across.
So in retrospect, sitting in Anchorage and looking at dots on a map, was it a fairly good choice?
It was a good choice from the standpoint of I wasn't overrun with other people. And would I choose that area again based on that? Yeah, I would. I would rather have a lot more elbow room than I would have the perfect spot. The perfect spot generally has somebody on it.
Now, how about the cabin building process? You know, that had to be a real challenge out there initially by yourself, but then with your wife. I mean, that's still a two-person crew.
Yeah, it was a challenge. We cut most of the logs and peeled them right there and then just hook a rope onto them, and we'd each pull and just drag it to the riverbank. When we had several there, we pushed them all in, kind of corralled them in the river with a canoe and drifted them down to the beach where we wanted. And then we had to reverse the process and pull them all up to the cabin site by hand or by come along in some instances. But it was a slow job getting them all there. And then getting them up on the wall, you know, that was another job for the come along, and I only had one. So, you know, I'd have to come along one end up part way and tie it off and then go get the other end up. You know, at first I could maybe make a round a day when the walls were low, but as things progressed and got higher and higher, I was down to like one log a day, you know, rather than a full round a day. From about April to December, I think we finally moved in about December into that particular cabin. That cabin was 30 by 30, divided into two rooms, so there were five log walls in it. Where you would normally have the ridge pole, there was a solid wall going up there with a doorway through it. So took a lot of creative notching. It wasn't scribed or anything like that, but it was chinked with moss, and of course we were chinking it in November and December, so it was a matter of shoveling away snow, finding moss and scraping it up with a shovel and getting it into the cabin we were living in order to thaw it out enough to take it in and chink the walls of the other place.
I see a real smile on your face, and that's telling me that it was still good times.
That's true. Sure, it was. I've certainly since had my fill of building log buildings, but I have built a few more since that one. It was good times. It would have been better if I had just had the tools to do things with. You know, I was limited by what I had been able to bring with me. And of course, no electricity. You know, the only power tool was a chainsaw. I didn't think far enough ahead to have my wife or myself, both of us, get moss in order to chink with because we were so busy doing the other thing. You know, if I could sum up homesteading in one thought, it would be you're constantly taking something apart to get a bolt that'll fit something else to fix it long enough to do a job. You just never had the right stuff, you know, or something would break and you'd have no way to repair it. No facilities to weld. Just a jar of junk nuts and bolts would have been real handy to have. But pretty tough to get that stuff out there. No mail service, no barge service on that particular river. So everything had to be hauled in either by air or up the river. And you're pretty limited by what you could put in a small boat to get up the river.
So you did have a boat with you?
I didn't at that time, no. But by the next year, I did. And that's how we would get gasoline. And let's see, at that point, I'd have to go to Stony River Village to get mail.
And how far away was that?
That was about 35 or 40 miles by river. It's been an exciting life. I don't think if I could change anything, I think what I would do is just more of the same. It would have been nice to have had some things a little easier, but I don't think it would be nearly as fun.
So that little boy reading the Field and Stream back in Southern California.
I finally figured out which way's north.
You lived your dream.
I did. I always wanted to live where I could raise the window and shoot something. I certainly got that in spades.
Another thing that you mentioned was you felt like you could read the country and read the sign better. Did you find it all that the dogs, with their better senses than humans, that they helped you at all in that regard?
I'll tell you, the way they really did help me was, you know, oftentimes I would start in the fall from the east end of my line and head for the cabin in the center, of course with no trail, no blazed trail. The only way I found that trail was that lead dog. And he would take me to every trap. There were times I hadn't a clue about where I was. I mean, generally I knew, but you know, relative to where the next set was or even where the trail was from the last year, not a clue. I remember one time in particular, the trail that I could see went to my left and the dog wanted to go to the right. And I stopped him and hawed him back onto the other trail and said, all right, and he immediately jumped off to the right side of the trail. And I stopped him and made him get back on the trail and started to go again, and he immediately jumped off. Finally, I figured, well, why fight it? So I let him go to the right. They were having to break trail, and there was probably, you know, a foot and a half of snow or more. He eventually, within 200 yards, intersected the trail at a point we would eventually have arrived at had I gone left. But he just saved me about a half a mile of travel. And there's a loop, and he realized it, and I didn't.
He knew there was a shortcut.
Right, exactly. And how he knew that, I don't know. Maybe he could smell that trail was over there. Because I did notice on those occasions when we would start out with no trail, he would occasionally stop and just lift his head and sniff around and, you know, then decide, okay, it's this way, and just make a turn and go. And sure enough, he was always right. So I had to learn that there were times when he did know more about what we were doing than I did.
And even over the course of 7 or 8 months, there was still
enough scent. Of course, you know, he had a habit of sprinkling a lot of bushes, too, so I'm sure that helped him. It used to irritate me because you'd slow down a little bit or even come to a full stop while he did his thing, but it certainly paid off in the long run. Yeah, it's a pleasure to trap with a good dog team.
That's great stuff from a real woodsman. Now let's take a break and hear from some of our sponsors. Okay, we're back with you and listening to tales from Ken Deerdorf of McGrath in this next segment to a discussion of his favorite fur bearers, namely wolves and wolverines.
You were also talking about wolves there for a while. I'm sure you must have a few experiences about how smart they are and how hard to catch.
Well, you know, this last year I really got an education on wolves after nearly 30 years of trapping. I think I had killed 3 or 4 wolves in those years, and I've never really spent much time trying because the marten is the money fur, and the density of wolves was not that great where I trap. Things have really changed in the last couple of years since we have no lethal predator control anywhere in the state that I'm aware of, and certainly not in this game management unit. The wolf population has just increased astronomically. I would maybe see a free-running wolf once or twice every 5 years on my trap line. This last year, right at freeze-up, I was standing down on the bank. It was just maybe the 2nd or 3rd of November, and the river was just jamming. I could see it would be solid by morning. And I was just watching the ice, and I turned to walk back up to the cabin, and as I looked up river, I could see, I think there were 3 wolves just right on the shore ice on the far side coming down the river. So I sat down. They kept coming, and then they went up in the brush, but they were running the cut bank, and I knew that they were eventually going to hit this opening that was about 100 yards across the river. So I just lined up on the opening, and when the first one stepped into the opening, I shot it. And it went right down, and of course the other 2 ran back in the brush. So I figured, well, this will be solid enough to cross by morning. So I sat there for just a few more minutes watching that wolf make sure he didn't get up. And lo and behold, another one walked out of the brush and started eating that first one. So, and I shot that one. And within 60 seconds, a third one walked out and started eating the first one, and I shot that one. Just to shorten the story a little bit.
No, don't shorten it.
Well, I was starting, I was starting to get wet sitting there in that wet snow. So I thought, well, I'll go up and dry out and get some warmer clothes. And so I walked up to the cabin and stood by the stove for maybe 30 or 35 minutes and got something to sit on, went back down to the river and sat back down. And doggone it, here another one comes out. I'd been sitting there maybe 10 minutes. Another one steps out of the brush. And I shot that one. I was beginning to think, where's this going to end? Deja vu all over again. Eventually a fifth one stepped out, and I shot that one also.
So after all these years of seeing 1 or 2 every 5 years,
I've got 5 in a pile. You know, they were all within 6 or 7 feet of one another. Of course, couldn't cross the river to get them, but I figured, well, gee, as cold as it is, because it was below zero, I figured they'd be fine by morning. I could, get across there and police them up. So I sat there quite a bit longer, and then nothing else showed up. Next morning, I was down there just at first light, and there were 2 more sitting there. One, a big gray, had obviously a full belly. They'd been eating on these carcasses from the day before. And the one that was sitting there, I shot that one, and it went right down. And the black that was standing there with her jumped back into the brush, but then came out again, and I shot that one also. So out of never having seen them in those numbers before, I thought, well, this is just a fluke. But it wasn't a fluke. It continued most of the winter. That was 7. I managed to trap and snare another 10. And all but one of those was within 200 yards of that spot. So I got 17 out of that bunch. I thought, well, I've pretty much whacked this pack down to where it's probably not a threat any longer. But the 1st of February, they did kill a moose just about a quarter mile from the cabin. And I managed to take one more off of that kill. Only one of those 17 wolves was a male. And that I find pretty remarkable. I certainly don't have even a clue or a guess as or why that might be. But they were in pretty good shape. I caught 2, one in February that had a bald patch on his back about the size of your fist. But other than that, and other than the belly was real short and kind of reddish and curly and matted looking, but apparently no lice. And the other was the last one I caught on that moose kill. That was the 10th of March, and the thing looked like a cougar. It looked like it was covered with mohair rather than wolf hair. It just looked like an old teddy bear that had been the hair completely worn off of it, and that was the only male. But, Fish and Game has that hide now, and be interesting to see what they can find out about it. But I don't think it was parasites, you know, external at any rate. You know, but, so quite an influx of wolves.
And you trace that one interpretation, at least, is back to the movement of the Mulchatna herd into this area?
Yes. Now,
and
see,
enabled the wolves.
Moose hunting has certainly gone downhill. I think it's not only the wolves and the bears, but the air taxi operators in Anchorage with drop-off hunters, float trips and things like that. Used to take me, I mean, I could say, well, looks like this is the day we ought to get the moose. The weather's getting cooler, and so let's get it out of the way. Sometimes 30 to 60 minutes in the old days, and I'd have that moose. But now it'll take a week, and that is nothing more than just a decrease in the population. It's just not nearly what it used to be.
So you put it all together. There isn't any one cause to point to, but just a whole variety of things.
Right. Everybody says, well, it's hunting pressure, and somebody says, well, it's bears, and somebody says it's wolves. I think it's all of that. If you've got 100 moose in an area, and the hunters take 15 or 20, the wolves don't know that you've taken 15 or 20, and the bears don't know. They don't have a season or bag limit, and they're just trying to make a living too, you know, so you really can't fault them for doing what comes naturally to those guys. To say that we need to cut back on moose season, yeah, I think in certain instances we do. There are many places that we don't need a December or a November or a February season. Maybe there are places that do, but I think the welfare of the resource has to come first. And if that means that people have shorter seasons, that's what it's got to be. And if it also means that we do some lethal predator control, that's what it needs to be.
Well, you were talking about wolverines there for a while. Was there any one of those that gave you a particular challenge? You had a hard time picking them up and finally did?
Yeah, in fact, there was one I never did. He was checking my Martin line ahead of me. In one 24-hour period, he took 14. So he took the traps right along with him, several instances. And I tried everything I could to catch that particular wolverine and just never managed to do it. There was another one a few years ago that was on the far west end of my line, and I knew that was his territory for years and years. And again, I had tried and tried and tried to catch this guy. And I finally did 2 years ago, and he was missing a couple of toes off of one front foot, and I've still got him hanging in the other room over here. But that's a real mixed emotional type of thing, you know. Well, you're happy that you've got the wolverine and that you finally outsmarted this guy, or he's made a mistake, but then that guy's gone from your line, so it's like missing, you know, an old friend or something like that. You know, what are you going to do for another challenge? There always seems to be one. Those guys can always be challenging. You know, there's two types of wolverine. There's the bold, wary wolverine, and there's the bold, bold wolverine. And the bold, bold are easy to catch. And it's the bold wearies that can present the challenge to you.
Do you think the bold wary ones are ones that have been educated by losing a toe?
I don't think so. I think it's just a better gene pool. Of course, they're always the males. The females really do seem to be just a piece of cake to catch. I don't know whether it's trying to feed a pup that's back in a snow hole someplace or what. Just trying to keep up their own strength and find something else to take home, but I've never thought that females were tough to catch. And that reminds me of two unusual catches that I've made in my life, and one was a wolverine. It was in November of 1979. It was a very late freeze up, and I was able to trap Martin with a boat. And I was out checking my traps one day, and I saw where a beaver had been coming up through the ice and out on the land, just logging a little bit during the night. And there was no snow. You could see where he'd broken the ice and the slide marks and everything, where he'd come up. So I set a 330 right there, came back the next day, and sure enough, I'd caught a beaver in that 330, but he was all torn to shreds, just strewn all up and down the bank. And I had seen otter do that, so that was my assumption. You know, an otter's got to this guy, so I rough-skinned what was left. I took the carcass and I staked it back out in the water where it had been sliding, and I set that conibear underwater right in that slide. And I came back the next day, and I had a wolverine in that 330 underwater. It had obviously been him the day before, but I couldn't tell since there was no snow. He'd been willing to go right in underwater and under the ice if he had to get that beaver carcass back out of there. I had a lynx story, too, that I've got pictures of this one. I had a lynx come up to a marten pole set and reach up to where the zero was on the end of the pole, and he had obviously gotten a claw in that zero. As he was fighting it, he reached with his other front foot over into a clump of alder for leverage to pull against that trap. And the toenail came out of the trap, but he couldn't get his other foot out of the alder patch. It was wedged in between three or four different alders. And that's the way he died. I walked up there and I found that lynx laying there. I couldn't believe it. You know, the trap was hanging straight down and his foot was probably 15 or 20 inches below the trap and not in it, but the other one was stretched way out there in that clump of alders.
So now, is this a method that you advocate that everybody try?
Absolutely. Always make your marten sets by a pile of willow or alder. That's something else. Lynx is not only real good to eat for people, but boy, you practically had to beat the foxes off of it, you know, with a stick. As good as beaver. They really liked it too, but I'll keep every one I can for me rather than, you know, let them have it. That's real good stuff.
Well, that's it for today. We're out of time. I hope you enjoyed hearing Ken Durdorf talk about his wilderness lifestyle. Join us again next Saturday at this time for another episode of Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.